call to order the August 1st, 2016 meeting of the Ferndale City Council. Will you rise with me as we salute our flag? And I will ask Councilmember Taylor to lead us this evening.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Please be seated.
A little more spirit into it, people.
City Clerk Susan Dunkel will do the roll call.
Councilmember Czar.
Here.
Councilmember Hanson.
Here.
Councilmember Olson.
Here.
Councilmember Taylor.
Here.
Councilmember Watson.
Present.
Councilmember Goodrich.
Here.
And Councilmember Bursch has requested an excuse absent. Would that motion be made, please?
So moved.
Second. So moved and seconded to excuse Councilmember Bursch. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. It is passed and Councilmember Bursch is excused. We now go on to public comment. This is the time during each meeting where we invite you to talk to us, talk to your city council and your government on about anything on your mind that's not on the agenda later. So if you have a program tonight, if you see it's on the agenda later, hang tight for that. But if it's not, come to the microphone and you have 3 minutes. Name and address, please. Go ahead.
Papa John, 6072 Malloy Avenue, Malloy Adult Family Home. First, we'll start off with hopefully some levity. What did Paul Revere say when he finished his famous rite? He said, "Whoa! What makes the Leaning Tower of Pizza lean?" And the answer is not enough nutrition. What is the end? What's the end of the beginning to be end of the ending? The end of the beginning, the end of the beginning is obviously either your choice, G or ING. Very profound, I know. I have a cowboy friend that said that I should buy a dachshund, a sausage dog, because he wanted me to get along a little doggy. Now, this one's philosophical for those who are in depth of thinking. I think, therefore I think. How's that very profound? Which means you found a professional found it, not an amateur, right? And have a profound get. Again, one more time for you, it is a profound thing. I think, therefore I think. Right? Now, on the serious side, I do have a serious side. Money can buy some things, but it can't buy other things. So, as I say this, money can buy a bed, but not sleep. Money can buy books, but not wisdom. Money can buy food, but not an appetite. Money can buy finery, but not true beauty. Money can buy a house, but not a home. Money can buy medicine, but not health. Money can buy pleasure, but not peace. Money can buy luxury, but not a life. Money can buy amusements, but not joy. Money can buy life insurance, but not life assurance. Money can buy stuff, but not a savior.
Thank you, Mr. Robinson. Thank you very much. Anyone else would like to speak to council tonight? Seeing none, we will close the public comment, and we will move on to consent agenda. Do I have a motion to adopt the consent agenda?
I'll move.
So we moved and seconded it to adopt the consent agenda. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay, and the consent agenda has been adopted. Moving on to item C, a contract with Wilson. Actually, does he have a contract with Wilson Engineering Wastewater? A discussion. It does contract, but it is a discussion. Mike Olinger? Nope. Kevin Rentz, I guess. I see Mike's name all over the thing, but you're there for backup in the bullpen. Good.
Yeah, we'll get Mike up here, too.
It's good. Good, I think. Of course, yeah.
Kevin Rentz, Public Works Director. This evening we have Wilson Engineering here to give a presentation on the wastewater facilities plan that was prepared for the city of Ferndale. As you know, the city of Ferndale operates the wastewater utility within the city limits, and with that, we have certain requirements that we must fulfill. The permit that we have for our wastewater facility plan requires us that once we meet certain benchmarks that we plan for expansion of the plant. So we've reached 85% of the plant's capacity on multiple occasions, and therefore we are obligated to plan for the expansion of capacity at the wastewater facility. We contracted with Wilson to do a wastewater facilities plan, look at various options for upgrades and improvements to the wastewater treatment facility, and they're here to present that plan tonight. So we have Andy Law, Scott Wilson, and Jeff Fisher that are going to come up and give a presentation and then be available to answer questions following that. So with that, I will turn it over to Andy.
Thank you. Welcome back.
Thank you. All right. Well, thanks for having us here. Let's try to keep this brief.
Cool.
But give you all the highlights of what it's about. So just to give you some background, we'll give you some background first and then go over the guts of the facility plan and then provide the recommendations and costs, the bottom line part of the presentation. So as Kevin said, this is required by Ecology, this particular document, to as the first step in providing an update to the feasibility plan. And there was a little bit of a rush at first because of the jail coming, that was supposed to be coming online here in 2019. That's not happening, so we have a little bit of more breathing room for that now. So not a huge rush, but anyway. So as Kevin already mentioned, this is why the facility plan is being prepared as part of the five-year planning effort and then five-year planning and construction effort to get the treatment plant built, the upgrades that are required. So, there we go. So, this graphic just shows, I know there's a lot of lines in here, but the horizontal lines show what the limits of the treatment plant, the existing treatment plant are. Three lines, three different colors. One blue is for flow, and then the red and green are for the content of the wastewater, the pounds of juke or whatever in the wastewater that has to be treated, for lack of a better term. So, and then the curved lines are kind of showing how those three different things are increasing over time. So if you go out all the way to the end of the graph here to 2036, you can see where those curve projections intersect. And we've got about, I think, for flow, we've got about 1 million gallons per day more than the current limit of 3.2 million gallons. That's the design goal for the future treatment plan, to meet that projected future flow loading. And then the same goes for the solids and the organic content of the wastewater. We would be going from a limit of about 4,500 for organic matter to about 6,000 plus for that, and then to about 7,000 pounds per day for the solid load. This just gives it numbers, so the red highlighted items show where you got a little high, close to the limit in 2 years for BOD, that's the organic matter. And then 1 year, it was pretty high for the solids. That was those are both the three red numbers there. So it's getting close to the limit, and so the treatment plant does need to be built. Let's try to. So this is the existing treatment plant, and it was built in, as you, some of you probably know, it was built essentially re-upgraded in 1996. And I will let Scott continue on here with the.
Thank you, Amy. My name is Scott Wilson. I'm just going to talk about a little bit of the contents in there, including the evaluation of the existing facility and the alternatives. So as Amy mentioned, this is just showing an aerial of the existing plant, but when evaluating the current facilities, we looked at the items listed there. How well is it treating? How effective is it at treating wastewater right now? The condition of it, how reliable is it? Everything from is the concrete holding up? Are the basins rusting? And will they last over this next 20-year life that we are writing this facility plan around? We looked at the age and life expectancy of the existing components. A lot of it, like Andy mentioned, was some has been original from 1978, upgraded in 96, 98, and upgraded since. So there's a mix of pieces out there, and so we looked at each one and and evaluated it for, again, that 20-year life. The other things are capacity. Like those flow diagrams show, the 20-year projected flows are much higher, and we want to be able to meet a good peak flow, big rain day, with those, with all the components, so that we don't have any overloads and basins overflowing or anything like that. So we looked at capacity of the whole system in every piece just to make sure that it's going to work, or if it doesn't, what needs to be replaced. And then also redundancy. It's a requirement of Department of Ecology, and it's good practice also that the system is redundant. So if one piece breaks down for some reason, you have a backup for everything. So we evaluated everything for redundancy. This is just an example. I don't expect you to be able to read all of that. You have a printout, which maybe you can see more. But this is just showing an evaluation of a lot of the components based on flow and then also redundancy and recommendations on those. As an example, this is the Headworks screw pump system, and this is one where it was originally over-designed, so it's got quite a lot of capacity, three big screw pumps that meet the capacity of our 20-year projected peak flows. So that's great, and it's also redundant because each one of those meets that. So this is one where we're not recommending any upgrade, but we are, we are recommending that they be improved upon slightly, pulled out and recoded, take advantage of pulling those out and reline the channels, that kind of thing. And so that is just an example of each piece of the whole treatment plant is evaluated that way and what could be taken advantage of the time to make repairs and upgrades. Then again, we looked at the alternatives of what kind of treatment technology would work best for this future upgrade. And for that, the design criteria that Andy was mentioning is a Department of Ecology requirement that they lay out in the permit as far as you need to meet these requirements for your effluent. So we looked at the alternatives for this plant, assuming the current design criteria and also assuming future requirements, and such as nitrogen and ammonia requirements that will be added on to the permit likely. So we looked at all the options of what would have the best treatment effectiveness. Basically, what will it do its job under all conditions of a big rainy day or even under the low flow conditions. We looked at operations requirements, like how much of a burden is this going to be on the current labor, and how many more will the staffing require, that sort of thing. And then physical size, will it fit in the property that we have available to us? The space is limited out there, and so we wanted to make sure it's going to be the best option for the size of the facility currently in the layout of the property. And then obviously capital and operations costs. Is it cost effective? And then long term, what's the yearly operations cost? And so we evaluated probably a dozen options and then narrowed it down to, I think, six primary. And then from that, we found our selection of two main ones that we really liked the idea of, and they met a lot of these, and then it was more on the operator preferences. And so we went with Mike and Jason and viewed a couple of these plants around the state and just to look and get his opinion. He's weighed in on that as well. And that's what then led us to our recommendations, and Jeff will discuss those in a moment. Regulatory requirements. Another section of the facility plan is regulatory requirements and all the permitting that's going to be needed for this project. So we've worked with Yori here at the city and the other agencies and got a good estimate of what the permitting requirements are going to be. And this is just a short little summary of those. But there's a good plan that is in place that schedule-wise and working with city and these agencies to get these all taken care of. I'm going to hand it back to Andy now to talk about water reuse.
Sure thing. Just one other permitting thing that I don't know if we had it up there or not, but the whole treatment plant's in a floodplain, a regulated floodplain, so that's a big constraint on the project. It's a big deal to start filling in areas that are underneath, you know, underwater during the flood, the so-called theoretical flood event. So we've kind of limited our approach to working in the footprint that's already there, so we don't have to go through all the hurdles that go along with trying to build in the floodplains like so many developers go through. Anyway, so just wanted to make you aware of that. So as far as the treatment system goes, so we get a standard treatment system that meets all the requirements, but what if you wanted to reuse the water somehow, the treated water somehow? We're not proposing at this point that you implement this kind of thing other than maybe using the water in the treatment plant itself, but for use off-site, it requires a lot more permitting, a lot more extra treatment, and a lot more redundancy to make that happen. So, and to reuse the water would increase the cost of the system by $10 million or more, depending on how you get it. So we're not proposing that just from a cost point of view, and that there's not a big need to reuse that water. There's not a market for that water anyway at this point in time. So, but in the future, possibly there would be. So what would need to be done for just to allow for irrigation with the wastewater? You just have to add on a filtration system, an advanced filtration system to remove all of the solids, not just most of the solids. So that's the basic method to get it to the where you can actually reuse it off-site for irrigation water. There's some other things go along with that, but that's the main thing. And then to use it for groundwater injection to augment your aquifer, you would have to take another step and use reverse osmosis essentially to treat the water, which is another big step in the treatment process. So just so that you know what's involved in the future, potentially, if you want to reuse water. Then biosolids is another aspect of the whole system. It's always a significant part of the cost. You know, they say, as a rule of thumb, it's 20 to 25% of the cost of your wastewater treatment system. Yours is less than that. But currently, all of the biosolids is dredged annually out of the lagoons, and then most of it's spread on the field next to the lagoon where corn is grown, and then the rest of it is hauled off to Choker's farm up by Linda. So fortunately, I think we should be able to keep that system going, so not add any extra expense for biosolids as part of this capital improvement project. And on the plus side also, the superior treatment of the system and then allowing the biosolids to sit in the lagoon for the biosolids settling pond for a longer time will allow more application on the field, and less will have to be hauled outside, which is the more expensive part of that deal. So just a little primer on the biosolids. It's already being implemented right now. And then here we have a diagram of the treatment, the proposed alternative treatment plan. This is a bit different than what's currently out there, and Jeff will explain that and why it's different.
I'm Jeff Christner, Senior Project Engineer at Wilson Engineering. And so as Andy mentioned, this is our conceptual layout of the recommended alternative, which is extended aeration. And we want to take advantage of the existing footprint. So what we show are two aeration basins located in the North and South Lagoon, located and configured so that they're as close as possible, matching the existing groundwork to minimize the cut and fill needed.
And those are the rectangles right above the Wilson logo there, those two rectangles.
Yep. And to the west are two new clarifiers. So this process that we're proposing is an extended aeration activated sludge process, which will clarify and settle solids and return which provides the extra bonus of being able to denitrify in the future, and it's a more efficient process for removing solids.
So, and just as inside the current treatment plant doesn't remove ammonia, which is toxic to fish in the river, so colonies the requirements for larger discharge into the river is going to require more limits on that. So this proposed treatment plant will treat ammonia to a low level all year round. Currently, the ammonia is only treated to a low level in certain months of the year, summertime essentially. And then in the future, ecology will almost certainly put limits on nitrate, which is the oxidation product of ammonia. So yeah, that'll be a limit in Bellingham Bay and the Nooksack River. So this treatment plant will be able to remove that nitrate, which will be regulated by ecology in the near future, probably.
Yeah, so it's designed to provide a total nitrogen level of 8 to 10 milligrams per liter, including ammonia and nitrates. So this extended air process, so far we've designed 6 other treatment plants in the state that are similar to this. It's a proven treatment technology where, for example, in Moses Lake, they have 2 of these treatment plants, and
there's one.
Here's a case study showing one of them. Over the last several years, they've had perfect compliance with their discharge permit, which does include ammonia and nitrate levels that are around 8 milligrams per liter for their discharge. And as I mentioned, it is a smaller footprint than the lagoon. It does fit within the site constraints. We do show a little sliver on the north edge where we're going to be impacting the floodplain, and we talked with Murray about this. We're proposing to mitigate the sliver impact with some minor adjustments at similar grades, so as to not have any flood impacts overall.
And the west lagoon off to the left of the picture there is where the vital cells will still be digested and dredged every year. So that will remain essentially as is.
So this shows a new treatment plant that would be designed to handle flows and loads for the 20-year projections. But we also show, with a dashed line on the left side, a future clarifier and a future aeration basin that could be perhaps used beyond that 20-year period, but the next level of planning. There is extra room here for tertiary treatment if we were going to look at water reuse. But part of our design will include a plant water system, which is a treated effluent reuse on site that can be reused for on-site wash water, mechanical screens, spray use, and perhaps on-site irrigation. If we were to go off-site with that, we'd have to upgrade to Class A refined water, and it's another big step to require additional treatment. So this is the layout. Let's go to the next. Okay, so we're looking at the cost estimates. The top 2 treatment options that we looked at are oxidation ditch and extended air. So if you look at the bottom row and the third row, those show the 2 that made the most economical sense. And as I mentioned, we decided on extended air mainly because it's a more robust system. It fits within the site parameters closely for the North and South Lagoon. You can save money with a plastic liner instead of a concrete basin with that type of treatment option. Less O&M costs.
Yeah, you can see the bottom line in the lower right-hand corner is the cost over 20 years. $40 million, but the actual construction cost is about roughly $14 million for the FSO, $14, $15 million. So I guess that's kind of on par with your overpass project, I guess, in the scale. But and the far right column just includes the maintenance and operations costs over 20 years, which is just good for comparison, because some processes have higher operations costs. always good to look at that too.
And just so you know, that the acronyms SBR is sequencing batch reactor, MBR is membrane bioreactor. Okay, as far as schedule goes, we're looking. We have finalized and submit the facility plan at this point in time. We're giving a draft to the city and believe that we've covered all the points that we want to cover. We'll be ready to submit. It's going to need to go to Department of Ecology. They asked for a 90-day review at Department of Ecology. There's a chance it can get through it a little quicker. So we'll get that started when we're ready. Once it's approved by Ecology, then we want to move to final design, and that's something that could potentially happen this fall. We're looking at doing the construction 2 years from now, so 2018 and 2019 would be our proposed years for doing construction. One of the big milestones will be this winter. We want to get the permit applications into the city, the shoreline, critical area stuff, SEPA, just to hand it off to the city while they have time to go through that and help us with the permit process.
The construction would be, like Jeff said, in this start in the spring or summer of 2018 after bidding in the winter time there. And then the last phase of construction would be the following summer. But here's the general sequence of construction. The first part would be those outlined in blue, and then the green, and then the red, and then the second year would be finishing up rehabilitating the biosolids lagoon, and then the operations building. That's essentially how that construction would go.
I know there are probably questions from council. Is there any more from staff information? I know council will probably ask about what the finance director sort of had laid some of this out ahead of time. Maybe they're going to ask that, so maybe we can talk about that a little bit too. But anything else from staff?
I don't have anything to add. I think that Wilson's prepared a good report looking at the alternatives for upgrades to the plant. I think that they've come forward with a good recommendation that takes into consideration the needs for our permit compliance, affordability of the upgrade, as well as the ongoing operations and maintenance costs. The staffing requirements are a little bit higher than what we're currently at. I believe that Mike would be looking to add one extra staff member to proceed, you know, forward. Like, probably like to do that prior to the construction start, so that person could be on board during the construction phase of it and be familiar with all of the operation of the plant.
Very good. So I know the solid waste fund is always pretty robust and healthy. I don't know, Greg, I haven't asked you, but can you give us an idea? Is it healthy enough?
Well, right now, if you remember, we currently have some debt on our sewer plant that we refunded a few years ago. So this year is the last payment for that existing debt. So at the end of this year, actually in November, we will be debt-free, so to speak, in the sewer fund. That will free up, given what we think might be interest rates, that should free up debt service within our existing rate structures of about $10 million. So we're going to be looking for the delta, that other $8 million. We're going to be looking for some grant funds, and so there's also a possibility of adding some of those in, and then we'll probably need to then back into what sort of phased rate increase potentially would be needed to service the remainder of the debt.
Very good. Questions from council? A lot to think about. Councilmember Goodrich, please.
I have two questions. One is on this first chart here that had the flow rates and stuff. Do we know what caused those three peaks or where it went into the red?
The three peaks on those in red, yeah.
Yeah.
Not really. No. I can say it's hard to It's hard to parse that data, really. Some of it's just weather, you know.
Yeah.
You get a particularly rainy month, and then the flows go up. And that corresponds to solids going up. That shouldn't affect the organic loading. So why that becomes higher sometimes, it could be an artifact or sampling. A good sampling of the wastewater that month. You've got some biased samples. It's hard to come up with a logical explanation. I know you've got some big BOD discharge or organic matter discharges, such as hemp flares and botanic. If they suddenly increase their loading for 1 month, then that could also cause it to be higher 1 month. But it's hard to really say on those kinds of things.
My other question is, right? If I understand this right, the water that we put back in the Nook Sack is okay to put back in the Nook Sack, but it's not okay to use for irrigation or other uses?
By law, yeah, it can be used for this street.
It kind of seems kind of funny if it's okay to put into the river and it's not okay to use for irrigation or something without additional treatment. And I take it then with that kind of in mind, there would be no benefit to the PUD to buy water from us or what they get out of the Nook Sack, they probably wouldn't need anything from us. There's no way we can go back. Charge them for water like they used to charge us.
Yeah, I think the treatment that you would need is different than the treatment they currently exist, that they currently utilize to treat river water. Yeah, so I don't think we could.
They would probably not want it. Even if maybe not even if it was treated river, because it's just another regular step that they would have to comply with as far as all their customers getting reuse water.
So if we wanted to use the water for ConocoPhillips fields and stuff like that for irrigation, we'd have to do more to it?
Yes.
Yeah. And as part of the study, they evaluated the water reuse, and during the presentations, the price tag for that was about $10 million in order to do that. So it's a significant increase in cost for the facility, almost as much as the 50% of the construction.
It seems funny you can dump it in the river, but you can't water grass with it.
And we specifically did pose that question to the PUD and to the refineries, like saying, hey, if we treated this water to the standard would you want it, could you use it? And they said no. So we addressed that specific question.
Okay. Good question. Councilmember Watson.
I'm just curious, because that area is a flood zone, is there anything we can do to move some stuff farther away from the river or up a little? Because I noticed we're going to build this brand new building, but it looks like it's going to be right next to the river.
So the foundation of the building will be more than a foot above the mapped flood plain elevation.
The 100-year?
Yep. The flood plain basically circles the plant in the low areas around the perimeter. But the building and those basins are all protected by a berm, and they're elevated up above the elevation. In the 2004 floodplain map, it shows the 100-year flood elevation between 22 and 24, and what we're looking at for the building will be between 25 and 26 feet.
If those levees are overtopped somewhere and when the water starts flowing that way, it's basically going to flow through the entire site from east to west.
Mm-hmm.
No safe spot.
Okay. I was wondering if you
want to take advantage of that existing foundation that was there for the chlorine basins, mm-hmm. and that way you can save a lot of cost and put the building on top of that.
I'm wondering from an earthquake resiliency state, how do these buildings do? Could they take a 6 or a 7? Or I know that there's a chance the pipes would break, but I'm just curious about the buildings and the infrastructure.
Of the existing or?
And what? So would you be building this to?
To the latest IBC building requirements, okay. Which include the earthquake load.
But for the buildings you're going to reprocess, or repurpose, rather, do we know when those were built? Or
96,
okay.
98.
96.
Yeah.
Okay. I guess I'm just curious how much of an earthquake it would take to shift everything.
Yeah, and I think I'd have to read through, but we did... Our structural department did evaluate all the structures that we said these are going to continue on, and I think they gave an okay on those existing buildings. They're all three-story CMU block buildings that should be adequate, but I'll double-check.
Thank you.
Question? Councilmember Hanson.
I know that when we took a tour of the wastewater treatment plant back as new council members, I think one of the things that stood out to most of us was the quality of the lab facilities that are currently at the wastewater treatment plant. This project includes a significant upgrade to that, it seems. Is that correct?
It does.
So they get new lab and larger space, more room to work?
Yeah, that's one of the big reasons for the new control building.
Okay.
New lab facilities will be placed in this new control building.
And you will have more need of lab facilities with this running process too.
Okay. More questions from City Council?
Mine are for staff. Not for these.
I was just going to say the same thing. I'd like to hear from Mike and see if he has anything.
Bring him up. Mr. Olinger, you're on deck. And these will all be softball questions.
We've been planning this for quite some time. Looked at several other plants, taking the type of influence that we have and the different flow conditions we have, this will be our best bet for meeting permanent. So I'm excited about this plan. After this, we have to go out for an RFQ for design. That's our next step.
Mine are mostly, I guess, in the lack of a finance person. I guess, Greg, I remember how wildly popular this was in 1996 when we did it. It skyrocketed the rate. I remember, right, they said it was going to be good for 20, 25 years, and so we're right about at that, which is good. But how much did our population increase from 96 to here? I don't know.
That actually might be a Yuri question.
It roughly doubled, a little bit more than doubled from 96. We were probably around 5,000-6,000. We're at 13 now.
Interesting. I just don't know where we're going to get the extra money. I don't want to stifle business that comes in, but yet if we're reaching capacity and it's not all small business residential, yet we give large-scale users significant discounts on water rates and on sewer. Maybe we're going to have to start looking at that if we're going to have to pretty much come up with double what we need. We have $10 million, we're going to need $18 million. I'm going to go with the contingency $2 million thing. So we're going to need another $10
million.
I don't know. It's going to be an interesting talk.
Yeah, we're going to be looking at state and federal grants as well as potential for some phased rate increases. But right now, yeah, you're right. Our existing debt capacity within our existing rate structure is not sufficient to swap out the old debt for new debt.
Well, it's hopeful, I guess, at least half of it is, but it's the other half that's going to be as wildly popular as it was in 1996.
Exactly. The good thing is, you know, if we are going to be going to construction in 2018 and 19, that does give us a little bit of time, you know, to not only look at this, but then come up with a plan to see what sort of federal or state funding or we could come up with, and then possibly come back with some, again, maybe not all at once, but some phased debt increase. And we'll get into this quite a bit more when we start talking with our bond attorneys. Unlike your home mortgage, where it's pretty much a flat line where you pay the same amount, but over time it goes more to principal, more to interest, we have the ability, just not in sewer plants, but for all municipal debt, to really ladder the debt in certain ways such that you can actually make your principal payments higher in the later years and less in the early years to give a phased increase in rates. So that's something that we'll throw to our bond attorneys once we figure out exactly how much we'll be able, what we will need to service through an increase in rates, and they'll give us some recommendations on structuring that debt and then the resulting increases in rates. So hopefully it won't, I guess just a long way of saying, hopefully it won't be all at once, you know, and that shock that you kind of alluded to.
Kind of following with Councilmember Olson, would this justify a review of hookup fees?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And
yeah.
I'm also trying to remember, are we giving discounts to larger businesses, water, sewer? I've tried to remember that.
I was going to check into that because I'm not really familiar right now with. I know we have made changes over time to our water and sewer rate structure. It's just not, I do not believe we have a rate structure where the more you use, there's a straight mathematical correlation between that and what you pay. I think there's some tiers to it. But
it's
that's something we can look at.
Correct.
Yeah. And as far as the sewer connection fees, the purpose of sewer connection fees is not supposed to be related to your current operating costs. Your connection fees, not unlike our transportation impact fees, are supposed to have a direct mathematical relationship with the cost of those future improvements that will be necessitated by those future connections. And so, yeah, there is that trade-off, just as we talked about in transportation impact fees, about a sufficient level of connection or impact fees and growth. You could have huge impact fees, but if you don't have the growth, those fees could be, you know, $10 million a connection, and you won't get it. But you could also have very low connection fees and get a lot of growth and still not generate enough to service the future capital needs. And so there's a balance.
Councilmember Watson.
Question for Mike. How long does it take you to train a new employee? If you brought someone in, how long would it take before they were fully qualified?
Oh, it really depends on their skill set. But it can take 2 to 3 years before they're really comfortable with letting them out. And one thing to note, our treatment plan is getting difficult to be permanent. So this timeline is a decent timeline.
And one thing that, you know, the current design of the plant leads Mike to have to use quite a bit of chemical to meet those permit requirements. The new facility is going to be able to cut back on the chemical utilization within the facility. And then currently we're using a chlorine disinfection and then dechlorination system prior to discharge to the river. We can eliminate that with the new plant. It's envisioned that we'd be using a UV sterilization for that. So there's some, you know, benefits beyond.
Councilmember Goodrich.
Two questions. One was on the grant, possibly. Is this one of those things where we have to have the design on the shovel-ready type thing to get the grants?
It would certainly help. I mean, mostly because you then have a more refined cost estimate. But given the timing we're talking about, I think we're probably going to be looking at those opportunities rather soon. But then developing the plans and specifications, so when we get to a point where we could, with some specificity, dial in the cost, then we have a compelling story to tell our state legislators or federal legislators, or for that matter, there's even the county EDI funds that might be able to be used for something like this, because this is tied directly into economic development. It's hard to grow your city if you don't have water and sewer capacity. And that's been a convincing argument in the past. Well, it will be in the future. It'll probably depend on a lot of factors, most notably the other local demand for those monies.
The other question I have is stated that we have to do an RFQ for the design of this. My question is, we just paid Wilson to do all this fine work. Aren't they qualified to do the design, or do we have, you know, it seems like you have one company do thing and then go off to say bid and then get company B to come in and, you know.
Yeah, they I do
just
not
wonder
doubt
why we're doing do we legally have to
yes.
do it?
Oh, yes.
Okay. So we could end up going with another company even though Wilson did all this fine work.
Absolutely, us. Absolutely. We'll just have to see how it all works out.
That's some of our old stuff.
You piqued my curiosity with connection fees for things in the future. So I've written it down that perhaps we need to look at those now for what we know is coming.
Mm-hmm.
And help justify some of that.
Well, exactly. And like you say, you do have to justify them from the standpoint that they need to be mathematically associated with the cost of the future improvements. Just because, you know, so that could start to be done rather soon.
So once we approve this, that would be a stepping stone to that.
Very well could be. Because the sooner we get more refined cost estimates, the easier it will be able to discuss the connection fees and come up with what an appropriate amount might be.
Well, with that, I'll move the approval of AB 1608002.
Is there actually a need for a motion? This is discussion right now. What the need is.
Yeah, I believe this is just discussion.
We discussion, but we are sending this on to Department of Ecology. That's the next step in the process.
That would be the motion to move it to
Department of Ecology for review.
That is what your piece of paper says. So if you made an error, let me know and I will correct what I said.
No.
That would be me that made the error.
Oh,
It says we're not voting on the motion. Is not for the contract tonight, but to take.
So what would you like it to say?
Do we need to say anything?
Well, just approval for staff to forward this report on the Department of Ecology for review and eventual approval.
That's what I would like it to be, Susan.
I'll second that. It's been moved and seconded to send the report on to Ecology, which is the next step. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay, and it has passed. Thank you. Wilson Engineering.
When will we do the RFQ process?
We'll be entering into the RFQ process shortly. Mike has stuff drafted up, and we'll be advertising that.
So we kind of a parallel thing to the college stuff?
It'll go off for review, and we'll be working with the selection process for the consultant.
Very good. Going on, favorite topic of City Council is signalized traffic intersection. Mr. Renz, welcome back.
Thank you.
So, excuse me, my allergies have been killing me, so I have this cough right now. I've come forward to committee with the next steps in the traffic light study that we've been doing. Just to back up, I attached a copy of the previous work that Transphobe had done looking at the traffic lights in the downtown corridor where they were identifying the both the capabilities and the limitations of our signaling system within the downtown core, and then looking at what we can do for steps to go forward. The next phase in this process, we've put together a scope of work to do some design work and also some more revised information gathering on the traffic patterns. So what you have before you this evening is the next step in our traffic plan. Be looking at the a.m. and midday traffic flows to develop timing plans for the signals. Also looking at which intersections would benefit from having the turn movements separated out, as we discussed last time when Transpo was here, that none of the signal lights from 1st Avenue to 4th Avenue have the turning movements on a dedicated loop, that they're keyed in with the same movement as the mainline traffic. So looking at separating those out, developing a plan for modifications to the existing hardware to allow for those to be separated out, and then developing a timing plan to go along with that to come up with an optimized timing plan for the signals all the way through the downtown corridor. So from the first signal at Main and LeBounty through the 4th Avenue signal, with modifications to the hardware on the 1st Avenue through 4th Avenue signals. The signals that are existing on the east side of the river already have the turn lane movements separated out, but can benefit from a revised timing plan. So the scope of work here for Transpo to proceed forward is about $45,000 or $46,000 to get this next phase done. Following that, we'll be doing a bid for construction of the modifications that are identified through here for the four signals through the 1st through 4th Avenue, and then that 46 includes the development of the timing plans that can then be implemented into the signals through that downtown core. All of the work that's envisioned on being done through this is work that we would need to do
if we decide to move forward with either advanced signaling controllers or some other methodology going forward in the future, so it identifies all of the timing plans that would need to be developed for both the AM, the midday, and the PM peak times, as well as those turning movements and making sure that we're looking at, devising a timing plan that takes into consideration all the traffic flow within the city.
Council, questions? Councilmember Olson first.
It's going to cost us $45,000 to do left turn signal.
It's the there's
I wasn't at the community. I'm reading this, but I'm still not really getting the big picture. I don't see how that is going to help us any. What I see is we don't have signalization for those 1 through 4th Avenue, and that helter-skelter timing is what's backing everything up. I don't recall who I've also mentioned. I've watched the off-ramp signals, which we have no control over. Those are horrendous and causing a lot of our own problems. So I don't know how, mostly eastbound, I don't know how we're going to fix that if we have no control over it, but I don't see what we're going to really get for this $45,000 is going to fix it. I thought we've been told that this equipment isn't what we need in order to do that. I understand that. But why are we going to waste another $45,000 when we're not even changing out any of this equipment, correct?
We'd be adding equipment to the currently installed equipment. In the 1st through 4th corridor.
And that's included in the $45,000?
That not the physical equipment, but the design for those improvements, yes. The plans and specifications necessary to do the project to go forward with that is included in that. The engineering work to put the bid package together for that is included in that amount. So
all right.
What the work product that we're getting at the end of this is a bid package for the improvements and the revised timing plans that will optimize the flow through the corridor. So looking at all of the movements and traffic flow volumes and then developing a newly revised timing plan. And the work that Transpo's done on it is preliminary at this point, but the intent and what the concept going forward is that they expect to see about a 10% improvement in transit time through the Main Street corridor by optimization of the timing plan. So once we get the inputs, data inputs into it so that we can develop that timing plan, then we can go forward with the implementation of the timing plan, as well as augmenting the capabilities of the signals within that 1st through 4th corridor and then incorporating those newly advanced capabilities into that timing plan to take full advantage of it.
So this 10% is after we get the signalization or before that, and then we don't really know once the signalization is, we don't know what we're going to get.
The end product of the work that's envisioned here, both the revised signaling plan and the implementation of the hardware portion of it, is expected to have that 10%. So we're going to have some cost to actually put the improvements in place. So there's going to be, the turn signal heads on the actual lights themselves, as well as some improvements to the connections between the loops that are currently installed. And that's the portion that we need to do a little bit more. You'll see included in the scope of work is for them to go out and verify all of the wiring within that 1st through 4th corridor so that we know that it's either taken, that turning loop is either connected to the main loop at the junction box or it's connected to the main loop within the signaling cabinet, and then doing the design for that project to go forward and improve those.
I think that's a conservative estimate, 10%, if we get all this stuff lined up, but I'm going to vote for it in hopes that we do succeed better than 10%.
Yeah, and one thing that was indicated by the Transpo presentation when they came down was we're looking at a 10% time improvement in transit time throughout the corridor, but that within that 10%, you're looking at a greater improvement in what they refer to as the green banding, the time that you can expect to see a green light as you transit through the corridor. So from an individual driver perspective,
were hoping that that experience would be better. You know, at the same time, I just have to keep reinforcing the point that the PM peak hour, you know, we're not going to do away with traffic backups during the PM peak hour. But it's hopeful that with the revised timing plans and taking into consideration both, you know, the AM, PM, and midday times, that we'll be able to see improvement throughout the day so that your typical trip, you know, through the corridor, you'll have a better experience.
Thank you. Councilmember Goodrich.
In their study, is there a way, or are they going to be looking at the impact right now of the vehicles that are coming onto Main Street and turning right, where they trip the signal to stop, but yet they're long gone? Today I was coming back, and I was on the bridge. First Street turned red because somebody was coming up First Street and turned right onto Main Street to head east. Well, they were long gone, and yet we're sitting at a red light for no reason. The Second Street was green. Is this study going to take into consideration that type of impact right now that is happening? Because that happens at Second and Third as well, where people come onto Main Street and make a right turn, but they've tripped the signal, and the signal doesn't know the car is gone.
Yeah, without the dedicated capability to have, you know, without a dedicated turn lane that we can separate that person out, the signaling system sees that as a trigger. When the person comes up to it, it triggers the signal. And the, you know, without that dedicated turn lane, the signal has no ability to determine whether that person's going straight or turning. So we can identify.
Our First Street does have the dedicated right turn lane.
Yeah. So depending on where the
look at the fact that if we make that a separate trigger from the straight and left, that it would improve the signalization at first, because now it knows that, hey, this car is turning right and gone, so we're going to delay the tripping of the signal, whereas now it just...
Yeah. And, you know, like I've said, none of the turn movements trigger individual events. Each, whether it's a straight line or a turning movement within the Main Street corridor, left, right, any of those movements, they all are triggered in the system the same. So if a person comes up, it triggers the signal whether you're in a turn lane or not.
I know that today. But I'm saying, is there a study going to say that if we use First Street as an example, there's a straight left turn lane and there's a right turn lane. Right now they're connected. The signal doesn't know which one of those three movements you're going to make. In the future, will the signal know that there's a difference between those two lanes and therefore how to react and what impact that would have on the east-west flow of Main Street?
Yeah, the intent of separating out the turning movements is to be able to better facilitate those situations. So, as I said, they're going to be collecting further traffic count data with this, and those traffic counts will be utilized to develop the timing plan. So if we see that those turning movements are an important signaling trigger event for the signals, then we can incorporate that into the timing plan.
Because right now, First and Fourth are the only ones that have right turn lanes. Second and Third it's a straight with a left. So right turn movements, I mean, having a right turn thing at Second and Third is not going to make any difference there. It won't make any difference. There is no dedicated right turn lane unless we do like we did at Fourth, where the straight and left are the one end and the dedicated right turn lane, like Fourth and Third. Are they going to look at anything like that in this study?
They'll be evaluating all the turning movements within the downtown core. That's within the scope of work, is to do the traffic counts and evaluate the turning movements and see what benefit that we can get from separating those out and incorporating them into the next place.
Councilmember Watson? Let me clarify. Councilmember Watson.
I guess I'm just frustrated because we're going to spend $46,000. But this doesn't even include the equipment we're going to need to buy. Is that correct?
It does not.
How much will the equipment cost?
I don't have an identified cost for it because we don't know the scope of the number of turn detectors that will be envisioned by then.
So in all the times Transpo's studied our traffic, they've never done turns?
Just
straight through Main Street?
Data that we have is for PM peak times. And so we're not taking into account the full picture, so we can't make a signaling plan that takes anything into consideration other than the PMP. So we need to collect further on the AM and midday
get the turning data associated with it so that we can develop those signaling plans. And I do not have a full accounting of all of the work that Transpo has done in the past, but you know, they were tasked with looking at what they had in-house, and I sent them all of the traffic count data that I had available from the multiple sources that we have for traffic counts. They took into consideration the existing data and then evaluated what they would need in order to come up with the revised signaling plans, which is what's included in this.
I'm just frustrated because I don't know. I mean, so they're going to give us this data, and then they will use that data to design the electronics, the circuitry, basically. And then we will go send out an RFQ with this plan. You need to install this circuitry for us?
We'll have the plans and specifications for the improvements to the signaling system at the end of this report. Then we'll do a project, and based upon the cost estimate that's established with that, we'll either go off our small work roster or do a formal bid process to go forward with the improvements to the signaling station. There was a cost estimate that was included in the original report that kind of gave a ballpark figure for what those improvements were, and I think that the cost for separating out the turning movements and adding new detection capabilities, modifying the cabinets was $10,000, and then implementing some further revisions was $15,000 for separating out the turn detectors. So $25,000, I believe, was the cost that was associated with the hardware. Now, the portion of that could have been the design cost as well. So, you know, I think that kind of gives us an idea of about where we're at for costs for that.
So is this coming out of the 2016 streets fund, or?
I believe that we had discussed taking it out of, we're going to go with REIT-4 rather than 2016 street.
Yeah, we could even use traffic mitigation only because there are the TBD. Because this is supposed to increase flow, so it actually is an increase in the capacity.
Councilmember Hanson.
So with all of this and the timing plan and everything, we're still, though, dependent on Bellingham to come out and do the timing and the work on the light. So we still have that approval.
I don't see. That the integration of Bellingham into our signaling hardware is a bad thing or something that we would be looking to get away from. With the number of signals that we have installed in the city of Ferndale, I do not believe that it would be cost effective in any way, shape, or form to have an in-house person and equipment and training in order to do that capability in-house. We don't have enough signals in order to support that kind of effort. The type of individual that we'd be looking for is a slash between an electrician and a computer programmer and would not come with a small dollar cost associated with it, and that person would have very little to do. So,
when we finally get all this, we're going to get a presentation, I would assume, from Transpo, so that we can make sure that they're proposing what we want.
Correct. Included in the scope of work that's detailed there is a presentation from Transpo.
Plus, you're getting a nice video.
There you go, a little committee.
I'm sure we can get a model that has a video.
Councilmember Goodrich.
Let me see if I understood what you said. That as far as equipment, hardware costs, you're looking at about $25,000 to fix some of the turning loop things or something?
That was the cost estimate that was in the original report.
Because your predecessor used to talk about fixing the signals costing several hundred thousand dollars.
It depends on how far you want to take the effort. So what we're looking at doing is an incremental improvement to the signaling system within the downtown core and doing work that we can then leverage in the future for doing future upgrades if the benefit that we're looking to see isn't materialized.
Low-hanging fruit.
So the development of the timing plans, the gathering of the information, the increases to the detector loop capabilities within the downtown core are all work that we would have to do if we went in and did a full
like advanced signaling controller replacement, which would be in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. So it just depends on what side of the spectrum we want to be on with the improvements to the signaling. This is taking a stepped approach going forward, trying to make sure that anything that we do today can be utilized in the future so that we're not wasting money on things that we're going to take and throw away in the next phase of implementation and providing benefit that we can see today.
Councilmember Watson.
I'm just curious. We've talked about doing one way down Main Street for quite some time, long before I came to council. Is that something that they could model easily, that we could just look at it, you know, set up the model so that you just had one-way flow? I know people in Ferndale have talked about it for years, having one-way flow off the bridge, and then you come onto the bridge from first.
I could have the discussion with Transfo about.
I don't want to spend $45,000 for the model.
You know, and that's the thing is that when we start looking at, you know, where do we go from here and what, you know, what scenarios do we model? I mean, the sky's the limit at the permutations that we can come up with for routing traffic and signaling, and limiting that to something that we can see a, you know, quantifiable benefit with without going to the, you know, the extremes of modeling.
Kind of similarly, we've had that thought experiment about removing from 4 to 6 no left turns. Have they modeled that?
Like I said, we could come up with, you know, any number of permutations. I have not had a specific discussion with them about exactly which scenarios. I know that there's been the, we should, you know, get rid of the light at First Avenue, or we should do, you know, there's multiple things that have been floated as options out there. And I think that, you know, it's, we can look at different options available. But the key component here is that there's a large collection of data that we'll have that can then feed the model that can look at those things in a relatively cost-effective fashion. So I think that proceeding forward with this work does not preclude us from looking at different options on how we implement those signals through the core, but allows us to have greater flexibility.
Councilmember Goodrich? Kind of piggybacking on what Councilmember Watson was saying, we get all the time from our constituents, why don't we do this? Why don't we do this? You know, is there a way that we could just get Transpo to look at the one-way on Alder, one-way Main Street, eliminating first the thing, so that we can go back to people and say, yes, we spent the money, we looked at those options, and this was the best way to fix the problem, was to put the timing or do whatever X we end up doing. But I see us doing X that this report says, and the people are going to come back and say, well, what about the one way on Main Street? What about turning off First Street? Did you guys look at that? No, we didn't look at that. Well, why didn't you look at that? You know, so.
Well, why can't we just tell them, optimize the system? You have a system of flow. Optimize the system. Go through the model, find out what is the optimal flow pattern and the signalization required for the optimal flow pattern, and then tell us what to do. Because I feel like we're asking a dozen questions. I just want to know, what do we need to do to make it work best? And then we will do it. I don't want to sit here and argue about, I don't want to try and figure out, do I want them to turn right here or turn left there? I mean, you've got a computer model. Make it flow the best. Run it 1,000 times and then give me the 3 best flows and tell me how much it costs. Just saying. Because it's not rocket science. Because if it was, we would have been done 2 years ago.
Yeah, we spent a lot of money looking at Main Street and we still don't have a solution.
No, and we probably won't after this.
I'm not a traffic engineer, but if you have 4 blocks of 2-lane traffic and then you get to City Hall and you're going to pile those 2 lanes into 1 lane, that tells me we're going to have a problem right there at 4th Street and Main, because we have 2 lanes of northbound traffic, and then once we get to Main Street, 4th, they're going to have to funnel back into the one lane.
And that's why we have a computer.
Off at third, second and third, too.
Staff?
Wish
I could call for
that. I don't want to what if this to death. I'm with Kathy. Give it to them. And
I think that the situation we're faced with is we have lights on the Main Street corridor, and we're trying to address the Main Street corridor. If we start looking at revising the complete flow of traffic around the downtown corridor, we're mixing off-street stoplight or stop sign, stoplight, you know, without installing additional signals on the lanes that we would be diverting the traffic to, we're not going to be able to have optimized flow through there. I know that the concept of that one way going on Main Street, one way going on another street, has been floated out there with the analogy that Bellingham does it on State Street and Forest Street. Those streets were designed to operate in that fashion, and when you look at the way that they tie together at each end of that corridor, it's envisioned that that traffic's going to then blend back into the flow of traffic. That's not the way that our streets were constructed, and that's not the methodology that was that was envisioned when the design was laid out back in 1819, whatever, for the year one. So it's, it would be, I believe, a Band-Aid approach. But, I mean, I can have Transpo look at any permeation. The work that is envisioned in this study is the recommendation coming from the traffic engineer that we've been working with for a number of years as the best step forward for the modification for the signals through the Main Street corridor. So, you know, I put quite a bit of faith in Transpo. I think that they do quality work. I know that, that they've worked with the city for a long time, and you know that there's that kind of thought out there that they've done a lot of studying. But I'm hoping with doing this that we can do study and then implement. So I would like to see that we move forward with doing a little bit more investigation on what's out there and then move forward with an implementation so that we can see the benefit going forward.
With that said, in the interest of expediency, I'll move for approval of AB 1608-003.
Second. So moved by Councilmember Olson and seconded by Councilmember Hanson to approve contract. Discussion? Seeing none. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
Nay.
It has passed. Contract has been approved. 6-1 with Councilmember Watson voting
aye.
Nay. 5-1. Councilmember Watson voting no.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we have Mr. Burnett and a couple items related to Lego. I believe it's about Lego. Lego.
Yes. Lego, my Lego.
One of each.
Oh.
Just take one.
Wait, this is for the shoes.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor. Good evening, Council. Yori Burnett, Community Development Director.
I'm confused by the pages.
There is one that has two pages.
Okay, you got my second page.
Two pages.
And then there are two each with one page.
Three documents.
I apologize, it's confusing.
Yori Burnett, Community Development Director. We have before you two items. We are recommending that you consider the first one, which is a development agreement first, before you consider the zoning text amendment. And the reason why... the reason why we are recommending that you consider the development agreement first is because if you should choose to rezone the property as we have recommended, we feel that it is appropriate to have the development agreement in place first, rather than first rezoning it and then to have the development agreement fail. So I'm going to explain that development agreement first. You do have the ability to consider them both together, but again, the development agreement should not come last. Over the course of the summer, as part of the comprehensive plan amendment, we had an applicant, Tommy Truong, who is in the audience with us tonight, who requested that approximately 0.7 acres of vacant property to the west of Lego Lane have a comprehensive plan amendment change from medium density residential to high density residential in order to allow him, with a zoning text or a rezone, to put in multifamily development. And you can see the cursor on the screen is a property in question with to the southeast flagpole-shaped lot that stretches between the main property and Lego itself. The approximately just north of the cursor is Siddle Avenue, which is to the east. Siddle represents the existing zoning boundary between multifamily, which is to the south, and single-family residential, which is to the north. Currently, to the west of Lego, that zoning boundary ends at the multifamily development to the south, where both the subject property and the adjacent single-family residence to the east are single-family. The council, through a variety of actions, ultimately approved a comprehensive plan amendment for the subject property, changing it to high-density residential, effective August 8th, which is next Monday. The council did state that they had concerns over a subsequent rezone that would allow up to 20 units on the subject property based on the extending the relatively dense zoning and kind of perpetually extending it without a transition, concerns over traffic, concerns over a variety of other impacts associated with multifamily development. Staff and the city attorney had identified the possibility of a development agreement, which is before you tonight, which does allow and is authorized by Washington State cities to limit density, and it's specifically for these types of reasons, to limit density or place other controls in order to limit the impacts on surrounding areas. The intent is not to eliminate impacts or to prevent change from occurring, but to enable a more gradual transition or to make it more compatible. So the development agreement before you tonight has a couple of requirements. And by the way, the applicant, the property owner, has agreed to this. I know that he is in the audience and he can speak more to it. First, it would limit development to 12 multifamily units on the subject property with no units on that flagpole piece of property. So those are two of the requirements. It would also be a document that would be recorded and would last in perpetuity. In other words, it would apply to any future property owner until such time as the city council and the city council alone determines that it is appropriate to release the restrictions or to modify it in some manner. That is, in essence, the nature of what the development agreement itself is. And so we do not require a public hearing for the development agreement. However, you can choose to delay your consideration of the development agreement until after the public hearing for the rezone. I'm happy to answer any questions on the development agreement at this point.
On the development agreement, council, any questions? Councilmember Watson.
Can you show me where would they enter into the development?
It would be along what we call Primrose Lane,
okay.
Where we installed the trail, I think, 2 years ago. Incidentally, any development of the subject property would be required to keep that trail, if not necessarily in place, but to replicate it a little bit further to the north where there's an existing ditch, which is anticipated would be undergrounded and put into a pipe with then probably the trail on top of that.
Go ahead.
Councilmember Olson.
That would be within the 60-foot roadway that you're...
That is correct. That is correct.
So it would be the 60-foot roadway itself and then the trail to the north of that.
The trail would be within the 60-foot right-of-way itself. It would be where the utilities, such as the drainage and everything like that, would be. So it would in some ways replace the sidewalk on that north side with that protected trail.
So I'm not quite sure you're going to have I'm not familiar. Is there a gravel trail there?
There is a gravel trail right now.
So we're going to replace the gravel trail with a sidewalk to comply with that pathway?
There would be either a trail or a sidewalk that would convey pedestrians and bicyclists from Lego to the Mountain View School campus.
Which is it?
That would be based on the Public Works Director's determination as to precisely what it is. What we say in our Parks, Recreation, and Trails plan is that there will be a non-motorized conveyance between those two areas. It is not specific as far as it being a trail or not. We'd always anticipated there being a trail.
Well, don't we count sidewalks as trails?
Yes, we do.
Okay. I'm hesitant to allow a trail made of gravel that isn't going to be near as durable as a sidewalk. So I would like to see that clarified, at least one person would.
Mm-hmm. We don't have a design for the property or anything like that yet.
Well, that's true, but I don't want to leave an open door saying that you can put a gravel lot when there should be something that people who are mobility challenged can go along also. I guess we'll keep an eye on it, but then that's kind of what we get into, what we talked about before. I don't want to be redundant, is we want to know what we're approving before we approve it, not after the fact and then hear, oh, well, we did this. Well, that's not what we talked about, and I know you're constrained by that, and that's not your fault, but I know you see the frustrations in what I'm talking about.
Absolutely. It could be, and as we've said before, it might be 20 years before this is developed, or it might be 6 months, and we really don't know.
Okay, well, if it's the Public Works Director's decision, I guess he's heard how we feel, at least one of us, maybe. So what do we need to do to push that so that we need a vote on having it be a sidewalk instead of a trail? What would you like?
It wouldn't go in the developer's agreement, though.
We've heard what you're saying. It could go in the developer's agreement.
That was going to be my two questions, sort of two-part question. But we're really talking about, if you're talking about a concrete sidewalk versus a gravel trail, what we're really talking about is a three-quarter street. I mean, that's kind of what sidewalk on one side, and I guess the question would be, what would technically trigger a three-quarter street if that's indeed what we're going to wait on? Or, conversely, can we, and would the property owner obligate himself to a sidewalk on the north side through the developer agreement?
Well, it might not be this property that develops first, which is one of the reasons why we can't really be talking about this too much, is because it could
because
be
the properties
to the
north
that develop
still
first,
could develop,
which might then be obligated to put in.
Oh, okay.
So you can't use the development agreement to obligate folks.
I understand that. Yeah. You're right. But then we're not talking about a 60-foot street because we're only doing, what, half or three-quarters?
There's no real scenario where we would ever need a 60-foot street. I mean, that's bygone.
If we talk about, and we've had this meeting and the last one, if we talk about it's a 60-foot street, and now you're sitting here saying it's not a 60-foot street, that's aggravating.
It's a 60-foot right-of-way. Within it, I think what we have, 24 feet of travel lane. Two 12-foot travel lanes.
And so then we would do curb gutter and sidewalk along the north side of that. If we were envisioning that it was going to be a multiple-use trail, as you're indicating, the passageway to the sidewalk,
all right,
it would be a wider trail than what the 5 feet.
No, I understand the 12 feet because I have another thing that I'm familiar with now, because we don't want any parking on that. So it would be 12 feet, which is one lane of travel each way and no parking.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
It would be for that travel as, I haven't looked specifically at the right-of-way on the property next door to the west of it, but it's my understanding that the right-of-way ends at the school property to the west. So this road would never turn into, or I can't say never, but the existing right-of-way that we have doesn't connect to anything, so it would just be an access road for the 12 units that would be going in, and so that would be consistent with the two 12-foot travel lanes and then the curb gutter and sidewalk.
Okay.
Associated with that. So we would ensure that we've got that pedestrian connection between Lego and the school property to the west, and then we would size the sidewalk based upon what the needs are for that connection.
So then who's responsible for moving this gravel trail? Since it's really on the north side, it shouldn't be touched, correct?
Well, it's basically whomever comes first.
Yeah, I think the trail right now is kind of down the middle.
It is.
Oh, okay. It is. Yeah. So it doesn't skirt the northern edge.
No, you can see, you might be able to see, there's a little bit different color. Oh, well.
Oh, that was nice.
There's a little bit different color there in the green north of the trail. Right about there. That's all blackberries, or it was blackberries. I shouldn't say that. It used to be blackberries before we put the trail in. That's basically where the ditch is. So the ditch, as a condition of development, will more than likely be filled in with the trail then being able to go right on top of that ditch. So going up to the north about 15, 20 feet or so.
Okay, so this wouldn't really be any different than what we normally do. Whoever gets the northern property is going to have to deal with that. Okay.
And we have spoken to at least one of those owners of the northern property. And, in fact, I believe that the Olson family.
No relation.
No relation. Owns at least one, possibly two. And we've talked about to possible future developers about their need of whomever comes first.
All right. Thank you.
Councilmember Watson, then Councilmember Goodrich.
Just a question about zoning. So we had talked about this before. What is the maximum number of homes you could put in there now? If you didn't change the zoning?
For single-family residential at 0.7 acres, if they went through the cottage housing development, which clusters a little bit more, they would end up with potentially 9 to 10 units, single-family units, which on average generate about 130% of the trips of a multifamily.
And I guess I just wanted, because one of the letters said they didn't understand why we had done the reconsideration, and I had voted for reconsideration because I believed that there was going to be 21 units on this property. But if he's willing to accept 12 where there could be 10, I feel like it's only a difference of two. And so, you know, it's this compromise of, you know, giving us a chance to get a few more homes in there but not having 21 apartments in there. So that's why I did the reconsideration. Because, you know, you could have 10, or at this point he's agreed to 12, which I feel like is a nice compromise.
And I think, Mr. Murnett, you indicated that the traffic impact would actually cancel out less, 12 multifamily versus 10 single.
It does. The numbers do equate to less, where a single family generates, on average, each individual might generate differences, we know. On average, about 1.01 p.m. peak hour trips per unit, so at 10, you're at 10 trips, whereas multifamily, depending on the type, generates about 0.7, so there you end up at 9.4 or so, or no, I'm sorry, 8.4 trips.
You did that all in your head, didn't you?
And
NASA.
Councilmember Goodrich-Smith, I just want the audience to know that though this is not a public hearing, we will allow public comment. So I don't want you to think we're not going to participate. But we'll get to it. Councilmember Goodrich.
I just want to thank staff for coming up with the idea of the developer agreement to kind of solve this issue, because this is not the only piece of property we're going to have this discussion with. As we do more development, especially in the city core area where we were required to increase our density, we're going to have other issues with this. And this is the first one, so it always gets the most attention and stuff. But I think this might be a good working thing for future pockets that we have around the city to help work with that, you know, single family versus multi-family versus multiple house development. So I just want to applaud you guys for coming up with whoever was all involved besides you and I guess attorneys or whatever, and the developer to even agree to something like this.
Well, thank you. And something like this helps us to identify where council's concerns, you know, are, and possibly looking at development agreements or text amendments where we can address this if it continues to come up.
I have to comment. You know, regardless of what council does, it is a beautiful piece of land. We can't say you can't develop here. Our existing zoning says 10 cottage homes or 12 cottage homes, whatever it is, the new zoning, unless we want to buy it. I mean, we can't just take land like that. So, Council, are you ready to hear from the public?
I was going to finish.
Please.
Are we doing public comment on the developer agreement, or are we going to do the public hearing?
On the developer agreement.
Well, we got the public hearing on the zoning map agreement, but there's no public hearing on the developer agreement.
Isn't the developer agreement moot if we don't do...
Correct. If you do not choose to rezone it, then the development agreement is moot. However, if you do not put yourself in a position of having adopted the development agreement, and if the reason why some of you would vote to rezone only based on the development agreement, then there would be a risk if you voted for the rezone first, only to have the majority of you oppose the development agreement. So in order to protect your wishes, we would recommend that you either vote on them both together, or you vote on the development agreement first, followed by the rezone. But there's no reason why you couldn't have the public hearing on the rezone first, combine them together, and then separate the two or have them both together.
We traditionally allow comment on non-public hearing items. I don't think it matters particularly. What is the wish of council?
I think what Brent's trying to do, well, correct me.
Well, I was going to make a motion to...
I just don't want to see... I don't want to have discussion on the developer agreement and then it pass and then have the same discussion on the public on the rezone.
I think if you speak once...
One bite at the apple. So if you want to put them together, however you want to do it so that we don't hear redundant...
Sure. Is that okay with council? So audience, this is technically not a public hearing, this part? This is public comment?
Well, we got a legal public hearing, don't we, on the zoning map? So that's why I'm confused. If we're doing the developer agreement, then we got the official public hearing is on item F here, which means you need to read the rules for a public hearing.
But we can set aside. We've talked about the developer agreement. We can set that aside right now and move to the public hearing, and then after the public hearing, we can vote on the developer agreement and then the rezone.
That's fine for me, too.
And now we will have, I would rather have
a... You just need to do the official, read the rules of
either,
public hearing.
Either way, we have to do that.
Yeah. So that's why I just want to make it clear. Are we doing the official public hearing on the zoning and the thing, or what are we... Just so we get the legalese down, that we do the start and stop and read the rules and all that stuff.
Yeah, I guess I would suggest, it's kind of a tomato, but I would suggest that you right now hold off on approving the developer agreement. Let's hold a public hearing for the rezone, and at that point, then depending on your wishes, you could have a motion to approve both.
Excellent.
Or okay. Neither.
We can do that. Good.
It sounds better when a boy asks.
Council, you ready to move on to the next, I believe, item then?
Correct.
Mr. Burnett, we're ready. Okay, so as far as the rezone is concerned, again, we have shown you where the existing zoning boundaries are. We've talked a little bit about what a rezone would do. Basically, what a rezone would do is it would now introduce a number of different uses from what are currently allowed. Specifically, it would introduce a variety of multifamily uses. The maximum density that could be realized without the development agreement in place would be approximately 20 units on this subject piece of property. Staff feels, as did the Planning Commission, that the rezone does make sense as it would tend to bring us to a more uniform boundary. You can see how it jogs down to the south. It does not include the property owner to the east. I believe that she is in the audience and she has submitted a written comment and may wish to provide a written comment. It has not included her property based on her opposition to the rezone and her opposition of being a part of the rezone. We believe that it is consistent with a comprehensive plan, which anticipates infill development, especially within relatively close proximity, walking distance of the downtown core. I do wish to enter into the record three comments that have been received. I can read these to you, but you have them yourself. Does the council wish me to read them? Or
no.
We do have a comment from property owner Chapman, from property owner or resident Argue, and from property owner Ashby as well. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
This is questions of a technical nature, as this is a public hearing. Seeing none, I think we can open the public hearing, and
we will do that at whatever time.
7:33:59. How's that sound? And we will read the Our city clerk, Susan Dunn, will read the instructions for public comment.
A public hearing is a formal opportunity to give testimony to the council for consideration in their decision-making process. Written comments may also be submitted to the city clerk prior to the beginning of the hearing. When the mayor calls your name, proceed as follows. Audience members who signed up prior to the beginning of our meeting will be called first to speak at this public hearing. If you were unable to sign up before the meeting, you will be given an opportunity to address the council once we've gotten through all the speakers listed on the hearing sheets. Each speaker should state his or her name and address for the record and will be given 3 minutes to address the council. When a large group of individuals supports the same position on an issue, we encourage the selection of one or two representatives to speak on behalf of the entire group.
Public hearing is open. If you'd like to speak on this item, please come forward, state your name and where you live, and you have 3 minutes. Welcome, sir.
Did you see that first map or that first picture you had up there?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, right here.
Can you state your name and address first, please? Thank you.
Selena Ashby, she's the actual owner. I live with her. My name's Wayne Smiley. Okay, this is our house right here. This ditch that they're talking about here, you can't see it. There's a telephone pole right in the middle of it also. That ditch is only about this wide. Right out of the raspberry bushes, these people's yard starts, and our yard starts right here. And it goes back, back to here. And they're talking about this area right here. I'm thinking, what happens to our property? I mean, when we bought this, it was single-family dwelling. And if we'd have known there's going to be some big development back behind us, we wouldn't have bought this property. We put our life savings into it. You know, and now it's depreciating value to begin with. There's going to be a lot more traffic. And what we're told, you can only build a house on every 6,000 square feet. And if that's the case, 7/10 of an acre is not 10 units. It's not even close. Six.
So is that going to be, that you said, is that non-motorized or that little road, Primrose, that lane, rocky gravel thing, is going to be cars on there or what? I'm trying to determine this from the last speech.
Community Development Director Burnett. Cars or trails, runners, walkers?
You said it was a non-motorized, Primrose Lane trail.
The 60-foot right-of-way would include what is essentially would be the driveway for the development to the north and the south, so that would include vehicles on it. And on the north side, there would be the continuation of that trail, where that trail would be moved up to be more or less where the ditch is now.
So there's going to be, if we figure, like I said in my letter, two cars. If indeed you've agreed on 12 rather than 20 units, and then we're versus 10 cottage houses, which whatever. So there's 24 cars on that little trail, right, whipping back and forth in front of our yard, in our front yard, basically.
Actually, our living room was over that.
Yeah.
You know, and like I said, we wouldn't have bought this.
I don't think anybody in this room would want that particularly. You know, I'm not opposed to single dwelling houses. I live and let live, but a bunch of multi-dwelling back there.
We lived in Seattle for a lot of years, so we know about living in a neighborhood. You know, we chose not to live where the apartments and
rental units surround us.
You know, we live in single dwelling.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate you coming. Any other comment from the public? Welcome back. Name and address.
Oh yeah, Jay Irwin, planning and development consultant for Mr. Truong. On his behalf, I'd like to again thank staff and the administration and the council for looking at the development agreement in the RCW as an option. This is there to mitigate impacts of actions like this, and it seems like certainly an appropriate level of development to keep it in character with the adjacent area. And I know it's when you're looking at raw land, certainly the comments or the concerns from the two new letters that you got, you know, that's understandable to look at vacant land like that and assume, certainly when you see the larger numbers that are allowed, that are potentially allowed under the multi-family dwelling zoning, it's easy to jump to that large conclusion of, oh my goodness, there are realities with development and height limitations in the development agreement, limiting it to two stories, and the numbers of units as well. I want to further point out, in addition to your, that traffic, if traffic is the concern, that those allowable dwelling units under the development agreement as proposed, 12 units, it does, multifamily generates just less traffic on average than single family. So when you look at the numbers of the potential, it's the concerns of the public are looking at it as, there was in one of the letters, open space. Well, it's currently zoned, well, single family. Now the comprehensive plan is high density, but the reality is that traffic is allowed to be there. You know, and I think you guys all understand that. But it's on Tommy's behalf to let you guys remember that, you know, that density is allowed there. Those traffic, those unit numbers are proposed to be there. Any issues with open space, neighborhood character do get taken into consideration under specific zoning and other development standards in place, including the trail system, that connector. Those issues do get, I don't think it's being open, wide open. Of course, we're getting the entitlements in place now, but at the time of development, those specific, I don't think there's a loophole there. I think there's the park, the trail system plan, Public Works, all comments to ensure public health and safety at that time. So again, thank you on Tommy's behalf. Hope you approve the rezone.
Okay, questions of a technical nature of this guest?
He raised his hand. Tommy was.
Oh. He'll be the next speaker.
Welcome. Your name and address, sir.
Yes, my name is Tommy, and I live at 5770 Lego, and I also, the old building is on the Sunny Brook. It's right here. Yeah. It's right here. This is my building. Yeah. And I live there since 2010. I just want to help, you know, City Council to help me. I just don't want to build it. This thing is right here. It's because I ask a lot of neighbors around there. They say it's because, you know, not everybody have the two cars. It's over there. My tenant is usually, you know, they have just one car. It's that I think not it's part of about the traffic. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Any questions of this guest? Any more?
Well, you know, why didn't you buy our house? I don't want to ask. It's out of order.
Folks can visit afterwards, please. Thank you. But thank you very much.
Also, like you said, everyone I've known that lived right across the street in that fourplex, they've all had two cars, every one of them. And they also have visitors.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you very much. Anyone else wish to speak in the public hearing? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing at whatever time they can tell over there. I got to move the clock someday. City Council, what is your pleasure? Councilmember Goodrich.
I'd like to make a motion that we accept the development agreement as presented by staff.
Second.
It's been moved by Councilmember Goodrich and seconded by Councilmember Azar to... are we doing two for one here? What are we doing here?
Sounds like just
it again.
Just
the development. Agreement. Any question by council? Any questions by council? Seeing none. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. And it passes 6-2-0. Going on, I think, to the next part. Council? Councilmember Goodrich.
I'll make a motion that we update or implement the zoning map amendment as presented.
Second.
Councilmember Goodrich moved and Councilmember Hanson seconded the zoning change and the comp plan. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. It is passed 6-0. Thank you, City Council.
Thank you, Council.
Thank you,
staff.
Audience, very much. Going on to mayor comments. We had old settlers this weekend. I just want to thank by name folks here. I hope I don't leave anybody out that worked really hard at old settlers this weekend. Councilmember Watson and Hanson cooking hot dogs all weekend. Councilmember Goodrich at the print shop all weekend. Chief Knapp was at the Veterans House. Our communications officer, Riley Sweeney, did a great job at the parade. And I think that was everybody. I hope that you came out and enjoyed it. Tomorrow night is the father-daughter dance. And even if you don't dance, it's really kind of fun. It's cute to see this go on. So 6 to 9, and it's free. And I think they serve ice cream down the Iron Park. Those are all the reports from the mayor. Councilmember reports. Councilmember Goodrich.
I just want to brag a little bit about my daughter. She is now a first-class petty officer with the U.S. Coast Guard, and she has taken on her new duty station in Juneau, Alaska, where she'll be in charge of engineering for Sector Alaska. Congratulations. 12 years in the Coast Guard.
Very good. Other council members? Staff, I'll just quickly say we're interviewing on the 18th five outstanding candidates for finance director. So hopefully I have that seat. You guys have to move over a little bit so we put another seat in there.
Yeah, please.
Community,
we'll put someone between you.
Staff report, Community Development Director Burnett.
I wanted to show you a few pictures. We just got these signs delivered to us today up at the public workshop, and sometime this summer, as time allows, we're going to put them in. These were provided to us. They were designed by Stephanie from our office, as well as one of our interns and myself. Our intern, Sarah, actually painted these pictures. They're going to go over, looking over Shell Marsh. This was an anonymous donor who donated as part of the library, where, as you can see, we're going to have four seasons. Who lives in a wetland in the autumn? Who lives in a wetland in the blank? Who lives in a wetland in the summer, spring, and winter? And with a lot of these interpretive signs, you go to it once, and you never go to it again because you've already read it. Mm-hmm. This way, you're going to be able to see how that one's just for a proof. You're going to be able to see how the wetland changes over the seasons. It also has the ability for us to take out these as we want to update them or replace them. So this is a pretty cool project. Ideally, you see in the bottom right-hand corner or the bottom left-hand corner there, we're working with the Boys and Girls Club and the Ferndale Public Library to do a kind of scavenger hunt or geocache where we're going to have these casts that are going to be around the area of footprints or leaf patterns where you can, this is the next phase. You
is this better than Pokemon?
Pokemon kind of stole our thunder, actually. We invented it first, and now we're not going to make any money. where you can go and find these things and be able to possibly be able to scan them, a QR code or something like that,
okay,
and to be able to see what the library has there. And we're hoping to work over years with the high school, Lummi Nation and others to talk about the historic significance of say, the Raven, potentially, to see what books or literature there is, maybe to be able to hear the call on there and to have a lower-tech version for folks that don't have these, possibly be able to do this as more of a tourist thing around Pioneer Park and other places, too. So if you can picture the library, the southern part of the parking lot where you're actually looking at the wetland mitigation area, it's going to be right in that area before you cross behind there on the trail. So it's going to be the jumping off point for, again, in the future, a possible boardwalk down to the BMX Park and Boys and Girls Club. So that's one, or four. The other one are the early proofs of the Star Park donor wall. This is from Science Plus. We expect that it's the
the design, and we believe the construction will all be donated as well. The concept is Star Park, obviously, we're continuing with the branding that we had. It's integrating the colors of Star Park as well. And the stars themselves are going to be reflecting the donors, with the larger being more the benefactor donor and the smaller being folks that have given time or money or other things. So we're hoping this will be able to be on site within about a month after the first week of school.
Well done. Thank you very much.
Goody.
Public Works.
Can you beat that?
I can't.
It's hard to go after Yuri.
I'm not even going to try. I have nothing.
City Administrator.
I'm also
Communications Officer Bradley Sweeney.
We got, if you haven't seen it already, we got the official Star Park video back, complete with time-lapse and the drone flyover. It's pretty neat. It's up on the website, and, of course, at cityofferndale.com/StarPark. And then the other thing is Operation Green Hornet. We're doing more planning for that. Councilmember Watson's been involved in it. We're going to do a full-scale active shooter drill at Horizon Middle School. It's going to be an elaborate work of cross-department teamwork between a lot of different organizations, and we're looking forward to being a part of it, and that'll be in October.
And we're not going to, nobody's going to know too much about it, because we want people to be able to react naturally, although Riley's going to make sure the public and work with the school district to make sure none of the kids get freaked out or the parents don't. But from a standpoint of city employees and council members, we're going to try and
right.
We'll send you a text or something and so let you know that something's happening so you could think about what you would really do in that situation.
So something's happening. Spoiler alert.
Yes.
I know some of you already know this, but I'm very pleased to have obtained my CMC Certified Municipal Clerk.
Very good. Chief of Police now.
I'd like to publicly acknowledge.
You're very welcome, sir.
I think we're okay. Are we ready for a motion for?
It was nice to see him as Grand Marshal of the parade. That was a beautiful coach they had you ride with the black and white.
Don't get used to the good life, I'm just saying.
Waiting for a motion to dismiss.
No, so moved.
Second. Moved in second. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.